Okay, ladies and gentlemen, welcome here to King's College. My name is Franz Burkhardt. I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Social Science and Public Policy here at King's College. I'm really delighted that you're all here this evening for Abiodun Alao's inaugural address, Africa, a Voice to be Heard, Not a Problem to be Solved. And I'm sure we're all looking forward greatly to that address. Before we start, some information about the event. This will be given by, well, as I've said, by Professor Alao. He's Professor of African Studies here at King's in the Africa Leadership Center. The vote of thanks will be given by Professor James Mayall, who's Emeritus Professor of International Relations at the University of Cambridge. And this will be followed by a wine reception at Chapters, which is in this building, and I'll tell you where that is at the end of the event. Quickly, for your information, this event is being recorded. An audio recording will be made available on the website, the King's website, during next week. The wine reception, as I've said, is upstairs, and we'll lead you there after the event. The nearest toilets are to the left and the right as you go out. And if for any reason we need to evacuate, then we need to go out in that direction, into the courtyard, into the quad, where we'll be led to a place of safety. We hope that doesn't happen, of course. Our next inaugural lecture here at King's, it will be given by Professor Jennifer Rubin, who is Deputy Director and Director of Analysis and Professor of Public Policy in the Policy Institute here at King's. And that will be entitled From Bridging to Field Building, Progress on 25 Years of Policy Research. So we very much welcome you here on the 24th of May in this place at the same time. So if I can invite Abiodun and Professor Mayall onto the stage. Well, as I say, it's a real pleasure to have you here. To use his own words, Professor Abiodun Alao was born, raised, and kicked around in Nigeria. This illustrious son of Nigeria has had a lifelong passion for all things African. And this stems in part from his love and the study of African history, which he started at the University of Ibadan in Nigeria. And after that, he proceeded to the University of Ilefe, where he did a master's degree in international relations with a mark of distinction. I have to say, we share a similarity there, because as a child I was brought up in Ibadan. So it's great that you're there's a Nigerian takeover happening. After the master's degree in Ife, and it was his pursuit of excellence that led to a Ford Foundation scholarship to study for a PhD here in war studies at King's College. When King's opened its door to this restless African, it unleashed a rare sort of scholar and personality, calm, even demure on the outside, while writing a dozen essays on the inside. A restless man. Indeed, Abiodun's restlessness is easily detected in the frequency of his walks along the corridors of the Strand campus, and in the number of trips made by foot between King's, the LSE, and SOAS in any week. Now, there are very famous philosophers, of course, who thought while walking. There's Nietzsche and Wittgenstein and Kant and so on, so you're in very good company there. It's in these moments that he dreams up his ideas for the next research project or visit to another African country. A pencil is an essential part of his dress. He occasionally stops during his walks to jot down what his next research idea or the title of a new article or book. His career took off from a South African perspective with a PhD thesis here on the War of Liberation in Zimbabwe. Since then, he has spread his tentacles across the entire continent. Indeed, Professor Alau is one of the very few scholars who's written a book on every region of sub-Saharan Africa. All his books have been published by prestigious publishing houses, usually university presses. Professor Alau has written on several themes, and on each he has left his mark. For example, his original thinking about the role of natural resources in the lives of Africans and in the politics of their relations at a time when few looked at natural resources as a conflict or governance issue in 1999, earned him grants and awards from two prestigious funding organizations, the MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation. One of the results of this, apart from two modules in the curriculum at King's College, is his seminal book, The Tragedy of Endowment, Natural Resources and Conflict in Africa. Professor Alau has a way with words, and his ability to coin beautiful phrases and craft titles is widely recognized among his peers. Listen to some of the titles of his articles and books. Diamonds are forever, but so also are controversies. Another one, the metamorphosis of the unorthodox. And finally, the burden of collective goodwill. Professor Abiodun Alau has also played major roles in bringing peace and stability to the African continent. Shortly after the Rwandan genocide, he was one of the four people who went into that country to draw up a comprehensive threat assessment for the country. He also co-authored the National Security Strategy Framework for Liberia after that country's bitter civil war. The African Union called on him to assist in the writing of the concept note for the Common Defense and Security Policy for the African continent, while the United Nations invited him to serve on the academic committee that advised the Office of the United Nations Secretary General during the civil war in Sierra Leone. Abiodun has traversed the African continent from Cape Town to Cairo. He blends in with local communities in all these countries with great ease. Whether one is talking of Kigali in Rwanda, Bujumbura in Burundi, or Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, Professor Alau knows the shops of local tailors, shoemakers, he's a very natty dresser, barbers and restaurants. Market women, I believe, greet him with joy at every reunion after a long break. Obviously a good customer. There is also a joke with everyone, and all consider him to be one of their own, with some of them even giving him local names. We call him Charles, of course. This ability to mix with people across the board has its own advantages, and at least on one occasion, it may have saved his life. During his trip to an African country undergoing civil crisis, someone drew a gun on him and demanded all his possessions. Professor Alau said he was 99% sure that there was no bullet in the gun, but he was also smart enough to realize that the 1% uncertainty may be the difference between life and death. He calmly engaged this young man and took up conversation with him. In the course of their discussion, it was discovered that they were both fanatical supporters of Arsenal Football Club. And in that, we also share a similar fanaticism. I'm discovering also. The discussion then shifted to which player Arsene Wenger should sell or buy, or whether indeed Arsene Wenger should resign his post immediately, perhaps. In the end, he gave the young person the equivalent of £10, which by that time was a gift, rather than something obtained under intimidation. Professor Alau's deep interest for Africa has now been extended to his children. His first child is studying politics and African studies at SOAS, while the second aspires to study international relations, I believe either here at King's College would be great, or perhaps the place over the road which shall be nameless. His solicitor wife has now come to realize that she has lost out completely where career choices for the children are concerned. Professor Alao has served as an important connector of African students and academics in the UK, and the respect they all have for him has earned him the title of elder statesman amongst his African colleagues. Professor Alao is a kind teacher, a great mentor, an electrifying intellect, and a genuine and time-tested friend who's been a joy to know and to work with.
Thank you very much indeed, Franz, for that. For a moment, I couldn't even recognize myself in that introduction. And let me also add my voice to that of Franz in welcoming you all to King's College London, and to thank you for taking time out of your various busy schedules to attend this lecture. I really appreciate it. As you all know, inaugural lectures are occasions for acknowledging intellectual debts. And so permit me first to recognize four people who knew when it all began. Professor Sir Lawrence Friedman, who was the head of World Studies Department when I came in as a student. And thank you very much, Professor Lawrence Friedman. Dr. Barry Paskin, who was my supervisor when I started my PhD and who saw me through the entire PhD. Thank you very much. I've not seen Barry as much as possible as she would since he retired from the college, but Barry, thank you very much for coming. And I must mention Professor James Mayer, who was one of those who examined my PhD and remained a very good friend when he was at the LSE and since he moved to become the first Sir Patrick Shea Professor of International Relations at Cambridge. Thank you very much, Professor Mayer. And finally, I want to recognize the presence of Professor Keith Hogarth, the former Vice Principal International at King's College. He was his most respected senior colleague and a very good friend. I know how incredibly busy you all are, and I want to thank you once again for coming. I believe in many ways you can consider this inaugural lecture to be one of the returns of your investment in me. Thank you. It's also a great joy for me to welcome my wife, Aronke, and our two really delightful children, Finfoda and Ajibola. Interestingly, I think this is the first time they've ever watched me deliver a lecture. We can debate it later whether they think I'm in the right job or not. Well, I hope you all understand if I recognize those who specifically traveled across continents to attend this. My sister Fumi, who came in from Sacramento in California yesterday. My younger brother Shayo, who came in from Nigeria. My brother-in-law, Jide Fawole, and his fiancée, Rowena, who came in from Australia yesterday. Thank you very much indeed. Again, I want to thank two of my family's closest friends, the Adeniyis and the Babalis, represented there by Dr. Anjumake Adeniyi and Alhaji Babali. Really, I don't know what I've done to deserve friends like you, but whatever it was, I'm glad I did it. Thank you very much. Again, I want to recognize the presence of my friend and colleague, Dr. Godwin Murunga, who came in from Kenya yesterday and is going tomorrow. He came purposely for this. Godwin, thank you very much. Thank you very much indeed. And again, I want to thank my schoolmates, Juma Ndalugi and Broderick Arubadi, who came in from Nigeria to represent the Federal Government College of Nigeria Student Association. Many thanks. Finally, I want to mention colleagues who organize all these events from behind the scene. Irona and her colleagues, I really appreciate this. Thank you. Now, before I start sounding like someone making an Academy Award acceptance speech, let me move to the business of the day. Ladies and gentlemen, inaugural lectures focusing on Africa are not common occurrences in British universities. One being delivered on Africa by an African, all the more so, making this perhaps the first to be delivered here at King's College London. But I stand before you this evening to represent a very long and successful connection. Not many people may know this, but King's College London has a very strong and unique relationship with the African continent. As far back as 1858, when the college was still less than 30 years old, Two Creoles of Nigerian descent, James Otten and William Davis, graduated as medical doctors from this college. One of these three people, James Otten, was an exceptionally remarkable student, so much so that the principal of King's College London in 1858, Richard Jowett, wrote a special testimonial on the 3rd of November 1858, in which he commended the young African for winning the college prize for surgery and for collecting 5 additional certificates of distinction in different branches of medical education. Apart from Otten and Davis, two other Nigerians, Nathaniel King and Obadiah Johnson, also graduated as medical doctors from King's College London in 1874 and 1884, respectively. This college indeed played a unique role in training the first set of medical doctors for West Africa, training 4 of the 8 pioneers of the medical profession in the region between 1858 and 1895. Although inquiries are still going on, no record has yet been found of any British university graduating an African from the continent before King's College London did 158 years ago. It may thus be the case that we are the first university in the United Kingdom to produce an African graduate. While this unique distinction should allow us the modesty of self-congratulations, it also imposes its own responsibility, as it now behoves us to give our connection with African continent greater publicity. Other universities with less remarkable attachment to the continent are already doing this. Now, more than 150 years after these trailblazers, I stand before you this evening to inaugurate a chair of African studies here at King's College London. My own trajectory to this position has been quite personally incidental. I came here as a doctoral student in 1987, and thanks to the kindness of the head of World Studies Department, Professor Leta Salaris Friedman, I was offered the opportunity to join the staff of the department. In a way, destiny seems to have decreed that I and another colleague and friend, Professor Funmi Odonisaki, will be among those to personify African studies in this college, at least in the fields of politics and security studies. From the moment Professor Odonisaki joined me on the staff of King's, we have tried to consolidate African studies in these two fields of study. If considerable success has attended our efforts in this direction, and I hope that it has, this is due mainly to the crop of genuinely wonderful students and colleagues that have worked with us. On my own part, I've tried as much as possible to ensure that the relationship between me and my students have been mutually beneficial. Sometimes they convinced me. Few times I convinced them. Most of the time, though, we all remain unconvinced. But the haunting obsession in every case is our determination to put Africa in the correct perspective to those who really want to know the truth about the continent. It is just appropriate, against this background, ladies and gentlemen, that this inaugural lecture is used more as an occasion to correctly situate the place of Africa in global perspective, and in doing this, correct some entrenched stereotypes about the continent. But just before I go into the topic of my lecture, permit me to make a statement about the professorial chair that I occupy, that of African Studies. I believe that any holder of a chair with that title must always confess to a measure of diffidence in holding it, and such a person cannot, unlike other professorial chairholder, consider himself or herself as the custodian of the esoteric. This is because it is difficult to call oneself an expert on a continent of a continent with 54 countries, more than 1 billion people, and several thousands of languages without looking like the dubious seller of a questionable intellectual product. Indeed, Africa is always an ongoing project, and I can only hope that the conferment of professorial chair on me will further enable me to study the continent more, and in the process, be in a position to bring more awareness to what an intellectual engaging African continent can mean to other regions of the world. Moving now to the subject of my lecture. The position I want to put forward in this lecture is easily predictable from the title. While I understand that the objective of the inaugural lecture is for the inaugurating professor to showcase his contribution to the discipline, I want to weave mine around a theme that has contemporary relevance, and one which underlines what I've tried to do in my career. The objective is to tell my audience that Africa is getting out of the pitiable condition that underlines negative stereotypes to it. I also want to argue that the future of the continent is bright, even if there are quite a number of things that the people have to do in order to get to the promised land. Indeed, Africa means different things to different people. Nothing brings this reality home to me more than the advert welcoming visitors to Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi, Kenya. The advert simply reads, "They call it Africa, we call it home." But it goes without saying that Africa is always at the receiving end of global vicissitudes that have been reflected in several academic and policy pronouncements. These negative views have been underlined by issues like civil wars, famine, high level of poverty, the pressure of the youth budge, and several others. Against this background, scores of phrases have been employed to describe the continent, including it being labeled as the dark or hopeless continent. Indeed, a question many have often asked, most of the time rhetorically, is how do we solve the African problem? In the various answers provided to this question, one sometimes finds oneself appalled by the extent of negative views about Africa, frustrated by the reluctance to appreciate the peculiarities of the continent, irritated by the simplistic presentation of Africans' views, disappointed by some African scholars' implicit endorsement of these negative assertions, outraged by the lack of recognition of some of the positive changes taking place on the continent, dissatisfied by the double standard with which judgments are passed about Africa, and above all, repulsed by the increasing nonchalant responses by some Africans to Afro-pessimism and stereotypical depictions of the continent of their birth. Broadly, I want to do a number of things in this lecture. First, I want to identify what I consider responsible for the negative stereotypes that existed about Africa. Second, I want to explain how things are turning around and how the continent is now becoming a voice to be heard rather than a problem to be solved. Third, I want to interrogate how the world is responding to the new voice of Africa. Fourth, I want to identify some of the issues that can stunt Africa's gradual emergence. And finally, I want to situate my place and that of King's College London in the rise of Africa's voice. Now, how Africa became a problem to be solved. I've tried in my research to first understand the reasons for the negative stereotypes about Africa, and I came to a number of conclusions. First, I concluded that colonialism was, without doubt, a game changer. In discussing the impact of colonialism, I recognize that some people are now trying to downgrade the importance of this historical occurrence in explaining Africa's problem. More than half a century after colonization, these people argue that Africa should advance stronger reasons to explain its predicament. After all, they argue, Africans were not the only people that experienced colonialism, and that other victims of colonial rule are now making giant strides. In short, by talking about colonialism after more than half a century of independence, these people think that Africa is merely making a three-course meal out of a sandwich. I disagree with this position. Yes, I consider that Africans were not the only people that were colonized. So also were the people in Asia and Latin America. But Africans were the only people that had their own colonial experience preceded by three centuries of slavery. So there was a case of double whammy in quick succession. While the consequences of colonialism are just too diverse, let me draw your attention to one of its consequences that is often overlooked. This is its impact on state formation in Africa. The forceful bringing together of people that have very little in common to form nation state has severe consequences. Imagine trying to forcefully create a united Europe where the French, the German, and the English will all have to live together and elect a single president. This is what colonialism imposed on Africa, and it was on this that the people have to involve nation states. I'm sure some of you will see the inevitability of instability in the scenario painted above. Indeed, we all know that cementing intergroup harmony among ethnic units that come together to form nation states is a long and tedious process. If the Scots and the English are still negotiating and discussing the terms of their association after more than 300 years of living together, nothing different should be expected of the Hausas and Yoruba in Nigeria after just 50 years. A second distinct reason why the traffic light always seems to change to red when it's Africa's turn was the timing of the continent's entrance into the international system. Imagine just about the time the Cold War was at its peak, African countries got wired into an international system they took no part in creating and one that was not designed to recognize them. But having inducted colonialism and external influences, one would be ridiculously dishonest not to concede that there were a number of self-inflicted wounds that brought Africa down. Yeah, I put considerable blame at the doorsteps of African elites. These elites, be they political, academic, or even religious, were responsible for some of the most callous acts against their population. Democratizing the looting of treasury rather than consolidating political democracy. Institutionalizing brutality instead of making the population secure. And entrenching nepotism instead of establishing structures around which sustainable development of the continent could be established. Indeed, it is clear beyond any shadow of doubt that right from independence, Africa has had a tragedy of leadership, and this perhaps helps to explain why the continent came to be perceived as a problem to be solved. But far more than all the causes identified above, negative stereotypes about Africa were entrenched because of the inability of Africans themselves to influence narratives about the continent. Indeed, Africa's negative reputation is based not on the magnitude of the challenges it was facing, but more because it was not in a position to shape narratives that go into global thinking about the continent. Anyone who determines the direction of the knowledge that you consume dictates everything that relates to your existence. The age-long saying that he who plays the pipers dictates the tune cannot be more appropriate than in the way external narratives dominate thinking, policy, and perception about Africa. Even the politics of knowledge production was for a long time not in favor of the continent. For example, right from kindergarten, African children were taught the popular nursery rhyme, A is for apple, when in reality most of the children had never seen apple because the fruit was not produced in many African countries. They therefore had to associate the alphabet A with the image of a product produced elsewhere, thus beginning the process whereby the knowledge they were consuming is externally conceived. As secondary school students, I remember, we studied the geography of North America when we were not encouraged to know the capital city of African countries apart from our own. In many universities, the expert of Napoleon Bonaparte was forced down the throat of history undergraduate students that were not exposed to the activities of Dedan Kimathi, who led the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya. In short, all through their history, Africans were gullibly mimicking narratives whose origin and intents they did not fully comprehend. All these were to have consequences that all contributed to the inconsequential recognition that is often given to Africa. Now, the rising of Africa's voice. In the last one or two decades, however, things have been changing. In line with what I just said, the change began after Africans started challenging foreign narratives about the continent. As will be shown later, George Sincerely and other colleagues here at King's College London have made modest contributions in this regard. But the original leadership of this emergent African voice came from policy practitioners and academics. For example, the Adebayo Adeleji-led Economic Commission for Africa forcefully challenged the World Bank and the IMF agreement over the introduction of structural adjustments. and came up with credible, evidence-based and authentic research to suggest alternative to the policy. A number of African-led research groups, like Orchestra in Senegal, joined universities like Dar es Salaam in Tanzania and Ahmadu Bello in Nigeria to champion the arrival of African-led narrative. Now, let me preface my discussion about Africa's rise with a clear statement of fact. When I say that Africa is now a voice to be heard, I do not mean that the continent is no longer facing major challenges that will keep it in global watch list. Before anyone reminds me, I'm aware of the problem in Burundi, in South Sudan, in Central African Republic, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Yes, I know that these countries are in the intensive care unit of Peace and Stability Hospital. I'm cognizant of Boko Haram in Nigeria, the activities of Al-Shabaab in Somalia, and the role of Al-Qaeda in Islamic Maghreb. Without doubt, these are problems that still face the continent, but they are not in any way significantly different from what is happening in many other continents that have not been so negatively stereotyped. I wish to reflect in this lecture on a number of key areas where Africa's voice is getting audible. First is the continent's natural resource endowment. Indeed, more than we think, the world depends on Africa in a number of strategic ways. The continent has about 30% of world known reserve of mineral resources, about 10% of its oil, 8% of its gas, the largest cobalt, diamond, platinum, and uranium reserves. Africa is the home to the second largest tropical forest. It has many of the world's greatest rivers, including River Nile, which is the longest in the world. Wildlife in East Africa, for example, has attracted global interest and attention. One can go against the home. The global impact of this are remarkable, and the world knows this. For example, the US Vice President Joe Biden noted recently that the annual importation of 50 billion worth of goods from Africa is keeping at least 250,000 Americans in employment. Also, the Republic of Niger, which is the world's fourth largest producer of uranium, supplies up to 10% of electricity to France. The Gulf of Guinea has now become strategic in global oil politics. The examples here again can be multiplied several times over. Arising from this is the changing attitude to the management of these resources. Once in the past, African natural resources were massively exploited without the people being able to question their leaders, now leaders are held accountable. Again, while foreign multinational companies had previously been milking the continent's resources with impunity, local populations are now asking questions. Although, as will be pointed out later in this lecture, there are still a number of challenges in the politics of natural resource management in Africa. However, remarkable progress has been made in this direction. Possibly because of this and many other factors, the economic situation in Africa is also changing. Of the 15 fastest growing economies in the world, 10 are from the African continent. More than a third of the population have climbed to the middle class. Still on the economy, more than ever before, the figures are now beginning to add up for the continent. According to the figures released by the United Nations, Africa's average growth of 5% is faster than the global average growth, with 8 of the world's 10 most performing countries coming from the continent. Indeed, things have never been this good for the African continent. From $600 billion in 2000, Africa's GDP increased threefold to 2.3 million in 2013. When it is considered that it took China 12 years to double its GDP per capita, and India 17 years to attain the same feat, albeit these are countries, Africa's threefold transition in 12 years is a noteworthy achievement. The continent again boasts of the youngest population in the world, and by 2040, it looks set to have the world's largest labor force, thus having an opportunity to be transformed into a global economic powerhouse. Socioeconomic and infrastructure development are also improving. significantly. Survival rates of infants have improved to about 36% in the last two decades. Even though it still remains one of the world's poorest, it has been an improvement over what it was before. Over the last two decades, Africa has also made unprecedented progress in the development of education. 60 million more children in sub-Saharan Africa are enrolled in primary schools today, with net enrollment rising from 52% in 1990 to 77% in 2011. Enrollment in secondary education has more than doubled from 20.8 million to 46.3 million during the same period. In the area of the establishment of democratic rule, Africa's voice is also increasing and becoming more credible. Even the few autocratic leaders in the continent are now realizing that their days are numbered and that the numbers are few indeed. With very few exceptions, all the countries in the continent are undergoing democratic transition. So successful elections have been organized in many African countries, with the incumbent government in some cases losing to the opposition. These are developments completely unthinkable a couple of decades ago. Of course, there are still a number of seat titers and third-term seekers, but things are significantly getting better. The continent has moved from an era when incumbents retain power by avoiding elections to one where elections are mandatory part of democratic process, however compromised. Although in the Democratic Republic of Congo and in Togo, we have had instances of sons succeeding their fathers in the cases of Joseph Kabila and Faure Yadema. Variance of this practice is not without precedence in other parts of the world. For example, Shirimabu Bandranaike became the Prime Minister of Ceylon, present-day Sri Lanka, after the assassination of her husband. While not too long ago, Raul Castro succeeded his brother Fidel as the Cuban leader. Consequently, a uniqueness picture cannot be painted of Africa in the practice of family members succeeding one another in office. Leaving this aside for a while, it seems certain that the greatest asset of Africa is its population, especially the youths. Presently, more than 60% of the continent's population is under 35 years. These youths are resilient and resourceful. While in the past they had always considered themselves as the neglected majority in an unjust social setup, African youths are now coming out forcefully to be the voice of the continent. For example, from nothing, youths in Nigeria developed the Nollywood film industry, making it the second largest in the world after India's Bollywood. And mark you, they did this without government interference. Young musicians across the continent are matching their European and American counterparts. In sports, African youths are making their mark even in foreign leagues, with one of them winning the African, European, and World Footballer of the Year awards all at once. Just last year, Nigeria's under 17 team won the FIFA World Cup for the fifth time, a feat unprecedented in the history of the competition. Yes, there are some youths engaged in fraudulent activities, especially internet scams, and their actions should be condemned. But I also believe that it takes a combination of intense greed and unimaginable foolishness to fall their victim. But on the whole, saying that significant positive changes are going on in Africa is definitely not a misplaced utterance. How the world is taking the new forceful voice of Africa. The anticipated success of Africa has naturally resulted in the emergence of a plethora of external Afro-enthusiasts who want to adapt the success of Africa to their own advantage. Already, both traditional global powers and emerging ones, with the assistance of the academics, are busy defining long-term strategies for engaging the continent. The joint strategy of warming up to African countries while rapidly buying their resources is an unfolding pattern. The pressure on Africa, both from traditional and emerging powers, now seems to be forcing Africa to make a choice between bad and awful. The growing involvement of China cannot escape attention here, and the complex ramification of this relationship is apt close watching. As we all know, the most common three-letter words in the world today are made in China. Hopefully, this will not in the near future be replaced by another three-letter word, this time around owned by China. If this is to happen, Africa and its resources should not be on top of the list of Chinese acquisitions. So how can Africa retain, consolidate, and advance? This now leads me to the next question. How can Africa ensure that its voice continues to be heard? First, the continent needs to recognize that its institutions are weak. Indeed, while my objective in this inaugural lecture is to dismiss, with the fury of an Old Testament prophet, the whole notion of Afro-pessimism, let me openly admit that I believe that the African continent is suffering from AIDS. This time around, however, I'm not talking of AIDS as in the disease, but AIDS, an acronym that stands for Acute Institutional Deficiency Syndrome. There are very few institutions across the continent around which credible structures can be built. Institutions on the continent are either completely weak or selectively efficient. The implications of this can be seen in everything. Consequently, the first step that should be taken to ensure is to ensure that the institutions are strong and credible. Also, for the African voice to be heard, the mortgaging of its resources has to stop. Across the continent, foreign countries and multinational corporations are acquiring huge expanse of land under arrangements whose awkwardness is visible to the blind. As we all know, land is undoubtedly the most important natural resource in Africa. Its importance transcends economics into a breadth of social, spiritual, and political significance. Among other things, land is considered as the place of birth, the place where the ancestors are laid to rest, where the Creator has designated to be passed down to successive generations, and the final resting place to every child born on its surface. Consequently, every society in Africa sees land as a natural resource that is held in trust for future generations, and the sacredness of this trust should be paramount in the minds of those negotiating the future of Africa's land. As I always tell my students, in Africa, people don't fight over diamonds or gold, not even over oil. Rather, they fight over the land accommodating these resources. Indeed, in my research into conflicts over natural resources in Africa, I have not come across any case where resources like diamond, gold, or oil have caused conflict. The publicity these resources have had in the security calculus is mainly because of their connections to the prolongation of conflicts, not reasons for their causes. Therefore, leasing out Africa's land has wider ramifications. In a callous world where multinational corporations and companies bargain with the most minimal conscience, African leaders should realize the popular saying that in life, you don't get what you deserve. Rather, you get what you negotiate. And African leaders should always negotiate right. This now leads me to the discussion on the whole place of natural resources in the politics of African voice, a subject around which I've made a modest contribution to literature. No doubt, Africa is a continent rich in natural resources, but poor in governance. It is this poverty in governance that explains many conflicts over natural resources in Africa. Interestingly, my research has shown that there is no direct correlation between natural resources and conflict beyond structures, processes, and actors associated with the management and control of these resources. For example, while diamond is at the center of conflict in Sierra Leone, the same resource has been responsible for Botswana's phenomenal economic growth. The gold that has thrown Democratic Republic of Congo into chaos is the same that is enabling South Africa to land all the way to the bank. In short, the impact of natural resources on the Socratic calculus is mainly a function of the laws and practices guiding the exploitation and management of these resources, and not the circumstances of their mere physical presence. Africa does need to get the management right. I would be remiss if I do not talk about corruption, a stigma that seems to have become somewhat synonymous with Africa. But before I do this, let me make two passing comments. First, although corruption is a very major problem in Africa, it is not a monopoly of the continent. The only difference is the politics of terminology that has been used to describe the situation in other parts of the world. For example, what is called corruption in Africa is presented as sleaze in another environment. And what is described in Africa as bribery is repackaged as cash for question in another context. Second is the fact that foreign countries and businesses have implicitly contributed to the problem of corruption in Africa. For example, not many people will know that until recently, paying bribes to foreign public officials was legally permitted. In fact, businessmen and women that have bribed foreign public officials could claim tax reliefs for such disbursement. It was only during the times of Klaus Schott as the Minister for Overseas Development that this practice was stopped. But putting aside the issue of terminology and the impact of foreign inducement, it must be publicly admitted that corruption is a very major problem in Africa, and one that can undermine the effectiveness of Africa's voice. The continent should, as a matter of urgency, build institutions and structures to curb corruption and stop wastage. Also, the continent needs to be more receptive to modern ideas. This position has been put more strongly by a senior colleague, Olufemi Taiwo. Indeed, there is a need to repudiate cultural practices that are antithetical to development. Questions and inquiries should be encouraged. Orthodoxies should be challenged. Unhealthy conversions should be rejected. Useful dissensions should be encouraged. Critical thinking should be prioritized. And innovative and path-breaking ideas, especially in youth, should be commended. In short, Africa needs to change. Of course, I know it is difficult to embrace change. As it is often said, the only person who likes change is a wet baby. But African and Africa should understand that change must come, and certain old practices will just have to go. Hiding other cultural practices to avoid doing practical things that can advance the continent is directly unreasonable. But above all, Africa should take over the process of controlling its own narratives. Dogmatic acceptance of narrative from outside is not only banal and devoid of logical thinking, but actually wrong and potentially very harmful. African universities should stop assuming that excellence is domiciled outside the continent. Indigenous erudition has to be encouraged, and teaching and research have to be seriously revamped. Also, African intellectuals in the diaspora must engage in constant conversation with the continent. As long as Africa relies on others to recount their experiences, more catalog of woes should be expected. As the popular African proverb says, until the lions tell their tales, the story of the hunt will always glorify the hunter. What I've done to amplify the African voice. Since the inaugural lecture is likely about an inaugurating professor, some of you will expect me to say something about how I got here and what I, as an individual, have done in the course of my career to amplify the African voice. Let me do this in few words. After a doctorate in world studies for a thesis on Zimbabwe, supervised by Barry Paskins, I remained committed to Southern Africa, publishing my first book on the region. Geographically, my book then began a clockwise move, first to West Africa, then East Africa, and then the entire continent. Thematically, I first published a book on dissidents and rebellion, and then switched to civil wars, then peacekeeping, and later turned to security sector reform, then anti-colonial agitation, and later to the politics of natural resource management. In 2013, however, I returned to Zimbabwe after more than two decades, where the McGill Queen's University Press in Canada published my book on Robert Mugabe. Currently, I'm looking at religious radicalization and political violence in Africa, especially the activities of Boko Haram in Nigeria, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. But apart from my published book, I've also related very closely with practitioners in virtually all international organizations working on Africa. Interacting with policy practitioners at the very top level of many of these organizations has shown me that there's a gap between the academic and the practitioner in any field, and this gap can be huge. While the academic is thinking to a conclusion, the practitioner is thinking to a decision. Again, while the academic is deciding what to think, the practitioner is deciding what to do. All these involve different mental processes, but interaction between both sides can be mutually beneficial, and Africa indeed needs more of this. However, far more than my research and policy work, I see my seats in the many students that I have taught, both here at King's College London and other African universities where I've taught, the people whose thesis I've supervised and examined, and those who, for one reason or the other, look up to me for leadership and direction. Distinguished ladies and gentlemen, it is my desire to keep inaugurating myself in the hearts and minds of these people long after today. What has King's College London done and is doing to give Africa voice? Drawing gradually to a close, one may ask, what has King's College London done to amplify the African voice? This is a legitimate question for a university that has been producing African graduates since 1858, clearly 18 years before Oxford University, whose own first African first, Christian Cole, matriculated in 1876, and 17 years before Cambridge, where so far we have traced its Africa to African first to George Nicol, who matriculated in 1875. Well, I can say without any shadow of doubt that King's College London is making significant impact and our activities have reached levels where we have earned ourselves global reputation for which we are indeed very proud. We established the African Leadership Center with the sole aim of addressing the leadership issue facing the continent and to give voice to the marginalized segment of the continent's population. Our first program was on the African Women's Security Fellowship, which was conceived to enhance the capacity of African women in discussions on peace and security. Women fellows were brought to King's College London, where they were trained on a specially designed program, after which they were attached to African regional organization for 6 months. Most of our fellows have done exceptionally well, with one of them currently serving as the Deputy Foreign Minister of an African country, Deputy Foreign Minister of an African country, while another has risen to the position of Deputy Director in one of Africa's foremost international organizations. Well, so you can see we have students in high places. Against the background of our success with the Women Fellowship, we established another fellowship program, this time around leading to the award of postgraduate master's degree. The objective here is to assist in providing young lecturers for African universities and thus contribute to the building of the next generation of African scholars and analysts who will in turn shape African narratives. So far, in 10 years, the African Leadership Center has brought a little over 100 young Africans to King's College London on our fellowship programs, and they have all returned to Africa, where they are contributing their quota to the development of the continent of their birth, while at the same time flying the King's College London flag high as always. In a couple of months' time, in June to be precise, they will be having their alumni reunion here in London, celebrating 10 years of the fellowship. Apart from our fellowship programs, the ALC is physically engaged on the continent. First, we have bridged the gap between diaspora and African population and African scholars. With the deep support of the college, we are negotiating joint degrees programs with universities across the continent. We have also been involved in policy formulation at the highest level in organizations like the United Nations, the African Union, and various regional economic communities. And I've signed memoranda of understanding with many of these organizations. We are also currently engaging senior level practitioners by asking them to come and share their experience of their international engagement here at King's College London. And finally, we are working on an arrangement where a retired African president will be coming to King's College London to participate in our African leadership programs. All these are part of our own efforts to show that Africa is now realizing its importance in a world that has previously treated it as being insignificant. Conclusion. Now, in concluding this lecture that inaugurates me as Professor of African Studies here at King's College London, let me say that I recognize that the burden on me and others who have to champion the study of Africa at this college is quite enormous. The college has placed a huge responsibility on us as it has mandated us to herald the dawn of a new era of African studies at the college. Reflecting on the place of King's College London, which was not a place traditionally known for its study of Africa, the inauguration of the Professor of African Studies is a testimony to the commitment of the college in writing new scripts about Africa, thus putting aside for a moment the content of this lecture and focusing primarily on the expectation of the college and our own determination to see this fulfilled. I think a way I can end this inaugural lecture is to borrow a leaf from what I consider to be the first inaugural lecture ever delivered. This was the one delivered by Jesus Christ when, just at the beginning of his assignment, he went to the synagogue in Nazareth and read from the book of prophet Isaiah, saying, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach gospel to the poor. He has sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captive, and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised." In the same way, I believe the Spirit of King's College London is upon us, because it has anointed us to preach a strong message to the world, to contribute to the healing of broken views about Africa, to preach deliverance to those held captive in erroneous belief about the continent, and in the process, assist in the recovery of good sight to those who see nothing but tragedies about Africa. This is a mandate that we have taken very seriously. Going back to the focus of this lecture, let me conclude by saying that in a world that ridicules the sluggish and demolishes the weak, Africa should not only be a continent in a hurry, but a continent hurrying for a purpose. Henceforth, when all the continents of the world come together to discuss development, never again should Africa look like the illegitimate child in a family reunion. Because far more than being a problem to be solved, the continent is indeed now a voice to be heard. I thank you all for your presence and your patience in listening to me.
Ladies and gentlemen, I was touched more than I can say when Abby Odden asked me to deliver this vote of thanks for his inspiring, and as always with everything that he does, exceedingly thoughtful inaugural lecture that we've just heard. Having heard it, I feel even more touched, but also deeply privileged being asked to do this. I've known him, I put down more or less since he arrived, but it's actually before he arrived to become a PhD student with Lawrence Friedman there, and with Barry. Where is Barry? Very. I first met him at IFE, which is, of course, not only the place where the world starts, but is the place where the first Department of International Relations on the African continent was established by Gideon Luko, who was in fact my second research student, which makes me feel very proud, but also quite incredibly ancient. I have to apologize for that. But apart from Jide and the department in Ile Ife, there were, of course, several of the younger staff members there, including Shola Ojo, Amadou Sese, and from the history department, Shola Akinrelade, all of whom had worked with me in the place that shall remain nameless, just across the orchard. The school across the road in the Aldwych did not exist when, as we have learned this evening, KCL's long association with Africa began. But I think Abiodun would probably agree that until he and Fumni arrived to apply the principles of good husbandry to this ancient seedbed, and of course events in the outside world simultaneously conspired to force Africa up the international agenda, it had largely lain fallow. It was in these circumstances that the LSE graduate school and the graduate course on African politics that I taught with Keith Panterbrick in the government department for over 30 years, and which produced this cast of characters who I've just mentioned. It was in these circumstances that I think we played a role in sort of holding the line until Abiodun and Fumni came along. And look at the consequences, ladies and gentlemen, in this room tonight. So it's a terrific achievement. And I think we, for them and for the study of contemporary Africa and for King's College, and they're all to be congratulated for seizing the baton so firmly and decisively. I'm sure we've all learned much from Abiodun's remarkable lecture this evening. I certainly have. But before I ask you, and believe me, I'm not going to rabbit on, I'll be very quick. Before I ask you to join me in expressing our thanks in the usual way, perhaps I could just pick up 2 points which are both embedded, I think, in, or at least implied, by his title. The first is that we live in a single world, not one that is neatly divided into those who create the problems and those who know how to solve them. The people who think they know how to solve them almost invariably don't. And if they listened more to the voice of the people whose problems they think they're solving, they might do a great deal better. Most African problems, and he told us about in the 2 weeks after Panama, rather appropriately, about corruption. Most African problems are our problems as well. And in throwing light on them and learning how to think about them, it requires both humility and the recognition that knowledge and experience are both two-way streets. The second observation follows from this. We need not, in the rather fashionable psychobabble to problematize the other. What we need to do is to listen to each other. As I listened tonight to Abby Urdan, I was reminded of an event that I've always counted as the beginning of my political education. I was a young, and I hope not arrogant, but certainly immensely ignorant, National Service officer in Nigeria. My teacher was a young Hausa boy of about my own age, and I was, I think, 19 at the time, straight out of school. We had been, I wasn't serving, I was on holiday, we'd been up to the edge of the Sahara selling cigarettes, 4 for a penny. They were very toxic. They were so toxic. They were so toxic that they'd been withdrawn. And the United Africa Company was trying to rebrand them and get them across. And on the way back from this trip, I sat for 300 miles across Latin. None of you have experienced this because you're all children of the resource-rich Nigeria. But I tell you, 300 miles of laterite roads in the back of a pickup truck. You need very strong springs. And we sat, this Hausa lad and myself, and he spoke, and again, of course, it never occurred to me. This is the arrogance of youth. Never occurred to me that he could speak such good English and I couldn't speak a word of Hausa. But fortunately, that was the case, and we were able to talk. And we talked all the way back when we weren't having our ribs practically shattered out of our rib cages. And because I was a sort of armchair lefty at the time, I said, don't you really feel that it's a shame that Nigeria's got to wait another 3 or 4 years, whatever, 3 or 4 years it was, before independence, when the Gold Coast up there, a smaller country, more insignificant country, is about to become independent. And my friend looked at me with withering contempt. I remember it even now. I mean, kindly contempt, but withering. He said, do you know what you're saying? What you're saying is that we should move to independence before educating our people. And what will happen? What will happen is the Igbos will take all our jobs. Now, I'm not making an ethnic point, because I say it was the beginning of my political education. Because the moral of the story is, of course, that things, and this was, I learned this very much from listening to Abby Urdan this evening, things are not always on the surface. You can't ignore the surface, but you have to look underneath the surface. 10 years, this was in 1956. So, just over 10 years later, I'd left the country a long time out before that. Left the army, but my own battalion, the 5th Battalion of the Nigeria Regiment, ran amok in the streets of Kano and started the exodus back to what became Biafra and triggered the civil war. Now that was, there were two, the moral of the story for me is not only that you need to look under the surface, but that if I can be biblical and return to Africa, the sins of the fathers are visited on the children to the third and fourth generation. Because the difficulty with the sins, quote, is that it wasn't self-conscious. You could say that indirect rule. You could say that indirect rule was actually, amongst colonial policies, one of the more sensitive. it at least, as it were, acknowledged local tradition and local culture. But of course, if you applied it in a place where people, the rulers, got on very well with you but didn't want to educate people, then the jobs that the colonial state needed were all taken by the people who were educated, and they were, since you know, brightness is not distributed geographically, but it goes up, it was resented, and it had consequences, and they were fairly terrible consequences. And that's, I think, one of the things that I take from this, that we cannot afford to think of Africa as exceptional. Of course, Africa is exceptional. Everywhere is exceptional. But it's also got all its own problems, as we have our own problems. We do things innocently. They have all sorts of intended, but also all sorts of unintended consequences. And that's the role of education. And I am extremely grateful and proud to feel that I've been a kind of played a little part in holding the game together until the African Studies program here with its two professors at KCL could get going in the splendid way that we've heard about tonight. And I'd like to ask you all to once again express what I know is your heartfelt gratitude.
Right, thank you very much indeed for that really interesting and warm and thought-provoking lecture, and also for the vote of thanks. Now, one of the things Professor Lau talked about a lot is the need for new narratives about Africa. The best way, of course, to tell stories is with a glass of wine in the hand, so that's what we should go and do right away. We will lead you, we're going to be directly above here, for a drink and to celebrate this great lecture. Thank you very much indeed.